So, I mean, learning about the Asian American movement, since the Chin case, and also the 92 LA riots, I think, for at least my generation, those are kind of the two key moments where Asian Americans have really spoken up about the injustices and things like that. I was really wondering why the Chin case in particular kind of brought the Asian American community together, because it wasn't just Chinese American.
No. This Chin case was, it was Pan-Asian, so it was every Asian SFA, you know, that was around got involved. And by then, during the 1980s, it began as Chinese American. Very soon was Japanese American too, because, you know, the JCL was there, organized, and Vincent Chin was attacked because he looked Japanese.
Yeah.
There was a Korean community. The Korean community became involved. Filipino groups. There were a number of Vietnamese refugees who were also being targeted with hate crimes and things. So, a South Asian community also began to get, you know, connected. So really, it became Pan-Asian pretty quickly. You know, it could have stayed Chinese if we had, you know, stayed in for that way. But I also think it was partly because a number of us activists, or I guess the people really active in that campaign, were younger, who had gone through the Asian American movement too. You know, there were people from the University of Michigan and Michigan State University, as well as from student organizing from Asian countries, you know, Malaysia, Hong Kong, Taiwan, who had been active or politically politicized, you know, when they were in college, who all sort of came together. There were also sort of Chinese Christian church leaders who had a tradition of justice. And, you know, and we're in Detroit, which, you know, the community being very sort of socially aware of racial injustice. So there were American groups that joined in, the Anti-Defamation League, there was an Arab Anti-Discrimination organization too, because the Detroit area is the largest Arab population outside of the Middle East. And so it quickly became very Pan-Asian, multiracial, you know, multicultural, and within the Pan-Asian, it was also a very multi-class movement, too. I mean, you know, Vincent's mother and father were restaurant workers and laundry workers, and he didn't come from a highfalutin kind of background at all. He was going to, you know, night school while he was a waiter. And so when we had demonstrations, we had the engineers and the PhDs and the scientists who were part of the, you know, GM technical lab, Ford technical, you know, who mostly spoke Mandarin, and they would be coming in from the suburbs, and then the Chinese restaurant owners and laundry owners, they would close down for a day. They would close and let their chefs, let the waiters, let everybody in the restaurant, their grandchildren go, their grandparents and their grandchildren go and be part of these demonstrations. And, you know, for a small, you know, immigrant business to shut down for a day so they could be part of a protest, that was huge. And so we had, you know, we had waiters and we had PhDs and, you know, and lawyers. I mean, it was like, it was incredibly multi-ethnic, you know, Pan-Asian and multi-class. I mean, it was amazing. And the reason was because everybody, you know, just from a human point of view, could see the injustice of, you know, you beat somebody to get to death and, you know, get probation. That was just plain wrong. But for Asian Americans, everybody felt like what happened to Vincent Chin could have happened to them. You know, the hatred was so, and the rhetoric, innuendo, from Washington, D.C. to across the nation was so intense that it was clear, you know, in our minds
like there was a climate of hate, and that climate that should have killed. And the climate hadn't disappeared. And if we didn't take a stand to show that, you know, it was not okay with us, and that we were not going to put up with this, that we were basically saying, it's okay, you can do it to my brother, to my son, to my father, to my sister, you know. And so I think that's why people stood up. And you know, the more people could see other people standing up and bringing attention to this, the more, you know, it's like the water's safe. We can go in.
Right.
You know, so I think it really did bring people together in that way. And there had never been a Pan-Asian mass movement before,
yeah.
You know, to that degree. The newspapers covered it, the New York Times covered it, on, you know, television. And so I think it meant a lot to people. We could finally have, it wasn't just that we were some exotic creatures from another planet, you know, being shown, you know, or Fu Manchu from another planet.
Mm-hmm.
It was that these are real issues that we have, and that there were real Asian Americans talking about it. So, you know, so it became a magnet for a lot of things. And a lot of organizations formed out of it. So the net, after 5 or 6 years of, you know, the core, and there were probably about 20 or so people who, I mean, we met every week, you know, maybe several times a week, depending on, you know. We all had jobs, we all had lives, people had families. This was like a second job and a second family that we had, because we all felt, you know, we wanted to make a difference. And we would meet at Chin's house. The other thing that was really important about this is that Mrs. Chin was willing to stand up and to be seen with this. And it was heartbreaking. Anybody who sees the documentary who killed Vincent Chin, I mean, you can just see, it tears her apart every time she has to speak about this. And I remember some people, you know, within our community, there's always people who are, you know, being critical of her, and they would say, well, of course she's going to speak up about her son. And it's like, no, you know what? Actually, when you're in so much pain, the easiest thing would be is to dig a hole and bury yourself in it and never go out and never have to open your pain up every time you talk about it. So it was, she was incredibly courageous to do that. And so she became, you know, kind of just a spiritual leader for us. I mean, she was a lot, I think, like a Rosa Parks in our Asian American community, because she was in her grief, in her agony, she could still stand up and speak, and she would say, our skin might be different, but our blood is red, it's the same. And she would say, I don't want any other mother to ever have this happen to their child. You know, and so, anyway, Mrs. Chin was really our touchstone on that. And because she was willing to speak, you know, because otherwise people say, well, if the family's not going to speak, who are we to, you know, get involved? And then we look like we're usurping the family or whatever. So, you know, she was our moral authority, our moral beacon, and she was part of everything. I mean, you know, there was no decision that was ever made that Mrs. Chin wasn't in the room knowing what it was. I mean, you know, when you watch Who Killed Mrs. Chin, the impression might be that Mrs. Chin's English wasn't so good. Actually, Mrs. Chin read 2 English language newspapers a day. She read the Free Press, she read the Point News, and she, you know, when she got spoke and, you know, inflicted so much pain, of course she was going to speak in Chinese most of the time, you know, and many of the situations were to a Chinese audience anyway, speaking Chinese, but she knew what was going on. And you say this, she says, I know what you're talking about. I mean, so anyway, she really did guide us. And the hardest thing was when it went all the way to federal court and then it was appealed. And so it got off. It got off, got free. That was the saddest day and the hardest thing. Mrs. Chin, who I got to be very close to, I mean, she called me her
goddaughter, I also forgot my godmother, and she turned to me and she said, Helen, is this true? Is there anything else we can do? You know, and I was the one who first said, no, we have to let people know it's not okay. I had to say, Mrs. Chin, there's nothing more we can do now. It's over. You know, we can file a liability, you know, a civil suit against him, which she did, against Ronald Edens and Michael Mintz, the killer, and she won. We can pursue different things, but the big thing about putting him in jail, and making him go to jail, there's nothing more we can do, and I think it broke her heart, truly broke her heart. And shortly after that, she moved to China, you know, to live out her days. It was just too painful being here. But, you know, I mean, that's where I have to say, as far as the role of women, there were, you know, it was also multi-gender, you know, in terms of the participation, you know, the leadership. There were a lot of women. Mrs. Chin was our leader. There was, you know, a very good mix of men and women who worked very well together, and a lot of women leaders, you know, who were part of that effort. And for purposes of this, we're running short of time, and I just want to say one other thing. I know you have a question, but out of the 5 or 6 years of working on this Vincent Chin case, we're also building a movement, an anti-Asian violence movement, and organizations sprang up elsewhere, New York, Boston, the National Group in Washington, LA, you know, San Francisco, and Washington, you know, state of Washington, places. So there were all these different advocacy groups, Texas, you know, where people, Ohio, you know, they were just groups that wanted to do something. And we began tracking. So we began tracking incidents of anti-Asian violence when something would come up. And there were, you know, various cases that went to court, terrible cases of, you know, teenagers who were stabbed to death. 5 second graders in Stockton, California who were gunned down in their school playground by a white supremacist. You know, cases that would come up all the time, and we started tracking them because there was no, you know, there was nobody else doing it, so we started doing it. And, you know, I got to a point where I probably had a list of 50 or 100, and it's been every ethnicity, you know, nobody was free of the violence. And, you know, so in those 80s, in those 1980s, there were many kids. I could recite them by, you know, I mean, I would talk about them. I knew every one of them. And at a certain point where I would talk about them, I realized every one of these is men. You know, we have 50 or 100 names of incidents we're tracking. What does that mean? Why are they all men? Why are they all men? Except for the 5 children, I think there were some girls in there. But, you know, ones where they were specifically targeted to, you know, be bludgeoned to death or something. Most of the cases were men, and we knew their names. And so out of that, there were other women, you know, especially here in San Francisco, who were doing work around violence against women. And we asked, why is it that the hate crimes are for men? And actually, after some digging, we found a few Asian names, Asian women, Asian girls. You know, a girl who was found hanging from a tree. You know, she was 8 years old, quite young, raped hanging from a tree right after Penthouse magazine had this thing about, you know, exotic, you know, pornography about Asian women, including a picture of one hanging from a tree. You know, they were all supposed to be dead. And so, who knows what the connection was. So, there was a Japanese American woman who was shot in her kitchen from outside on December 7th, you know, Pearl Harbor Day. They were, women who were targeted, sexually assaulted, and so we had a clue that not that there weren't hate crimes against Asian women. They just weren't called hate crimes.
Yeah.
The violence was also mixed with gender violence.
Right.
And because of that, they were shunted off to a sex crimes unit, and we all know that women are, you know, in crimes against women are secondary crimes. They're not really taken seriously anyway. And so they disappeared. So these Asian American women victims of really serial rapists who specifically targeted Asian women, serial rapists, serial killers. And so anyway, so that was where we got together. We had a little study group, and we wrote the paper for Making Waves 2, where are the Asian women, you know. And so the thing about having to consciously bring gender into it and to ask, you know, whereas the women, it's not like all these activists all over the country didn't know this list.
Yeah.
You know, we had all known this list. But it really took some Asian American women, Asian American feminists, to say, well, wait a minute. What's the pattern here? Where are the women? And we always have to ask, where are the women?
Yeah.
You know, and how does this? It's not like racism first and sexism later. It's like we have to actively, consciously, you know, always look and look for the Asian women. Just like we have to look for the Asian Americans. We don't look for them, you know, we'll be disappeared.
Yeah, yeah.
But also within our Asian American stuff, we have to look and say, where are the Asian American women? And then I would add to that, we have to look at, you know, sexual orientation, you know, disability, class, and linguistic, you know, ability, and all of the various things that get marginalized, because we will also marginalize within our own, you know, subset, but there are still, within that, we have to see who's privileged, who's disempowered, and so, so anyway, I did want to make that point about the violence, and there's a whole other topic that we don't have time for, to work around domestic violence, work around, you know, gender violence.
Mm-hmm.
But we're getting there.
Yeah, so a quick last wrap up question. I wanted to ask you a little bit more about the future, maybe. So you've been involved in the movement for a really long time, and I was hoping maybe you could pinpoint a couple of issues that you think are pertinent now, maybe in the future, kind of like the work that we still have to do.
Well, when I started, it was in the mid, 1960s, 1970s,
mm-hmm.
in the last century.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're, well, marching into this new century, new millennium. But some of the issues really haven't changed a whole lot. They've changed in different ways. I mean, when I started out, Asian Americans were, you know, like, 1%, maybe, less than 1% of the U.S. population. Now we're, overall, we're, 6%, something like that, but in states like California, we're, like, much more than that. And every state in the union and every community, you know, we're not invisible anymore. You know, there's 19 million of us in counting. And so that's a huge difference. And because of that, you could say that we have more visibility. But in terms of visibility of people's consciousness, in terms of what is race in America, we still talk about white, black, maybe brown. You know, I mean, Asians are, as far as I'm concerned, still pretty much off the map. You know, we're off the radar screen. And so for any issues that come up, like immigration, for example, this is like a huge issue right now for the country. For Asian Americans, it's maybe one of the number one issues, because more than any other community, there are a higher proportion of our community is immigrants than any other group. Now, Latinos, the vast majority of Latinos are born in America, you know. For Asian Americans, the vast majority of Asian Americans are born outside of America. And so immigration is our issue. But if you were to look at any of the news or the pundits or anything about immigration, there's nothing about Asian
America. It's a Latino issue, that's
right. Right. It's pegged as a Latino issue, and I don't think Latinos feel that that's right either. Like, that's not our only issue. Not every Latino is a, quote, illegal, you know, undocumented the issue isn't simple either. I mean, it's not that it's simple for anybody, but we have multiple, you know, languages and religions, and we're, you know, hugely unhomogeneous, you know, compared to any other group, too. So dealing with immigration for Asian Americans has a lot of layers to it. And, you know, so I think this is big. And as far as visibility, what it means is, you know, for Asian Americans, we have to be there. We have to make sure we're seen. We have to make sure we're heard. We have to talk about it. We have to talk about what it means for Asian American women and bring gender into it, too, because, you know, this last wave of migration, worldwide migration of people who have been displaced, was largely a female migration. Women who were dispossessed. And that brings a whole other layer of, you know, vulnerability that women have to violence, to lack of power, to, you know, sexual violence, to the need to care for children and parents, and, you know, because women are caregivers of society, too. So anyway, so I would say that is, for now, a huge one. And the visibility question, I don't see that as going away. I think as still an activist at heart, I think we have a way to go to be the visible national force that we need. I mean, there still is no national organization for Asian Americans, you know, like there is a national organization for women. There's no NAACP for Asian Americans. There's no, you know, La Raza or Anti-Defamation League, you know, the voice that people turn to. And we need that. I mean, we totally need that. And the national advocacy. And I'm hoping it'll happen in my lifetime, though I'm not really sure. I think if it does, it'll be your generation to make it happen. And, you know, we're getting there. There is a challenge, though. As our numbers grow, and now we're at, you know, 19 million, it's easier to stay, to keep an issue like the Vincent Chin case, to keep it as a Chinese issue, you know, because the Chinese community now is quite large, you know, we're not claiming that as our issue. When the LA riots happened, you know, with the LA civil unrest, however that, you know, the terminology for it, I think a lot of the non-Korean community, Asian American community, sat on the sidelines because they said, well, that's a Korean issue, we shouldn't step in. And my perspective, coming, especially coming from the Vincent Chin case on the East Coast, is no, this is a community issue. I mean, when people are being attacked, they don't know whether somebody's Korean or you know, Russian. Mm-hmm. They stop and ask you. And so I think that by 1992, there was already some, I guess I would say, disaggregation of the Asian, less cohesion,
right,
of the Asian American community, especially in California, because the numbers are so large.
Right.
If the Vincent Chin case had happened in California, I question whether it could have been as pan-Asian as well. In Michigan, there was no question. There were so few Chinese and so few Asian Americans that to do anything, we knew we had to stick together. And not only that, we knew we had to reach out and join in coalition with other groups, because we were, even as a pan-Asian group, we were too small. In a state like California, where you could say, well, there's a really large Korean community, you know, maybe the Koreans don't want us Chinese to be involved, you know, and then you go through a few days and you're not spokesperson, how do you manage that communication? It does become more difficult and more challenging, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. And so I think that's a challenge for our Asian American activists and activism ahead, because it's not an automatic thing, especially since we're largely immigrants still. You know, the immigrants, like my parents, you know, still think of their sending country as, you know, their identity, not pan-Asian. And so it's not to them, the immigrants, a natural thing to reach out to the, what five, 2-point generations of beyond, it's much more like, oh yeah, of course, you know, and Asian, well, yeah, sure, it's a big deal. You know, I don't hate, I'm Chinese American, but I'll speak to Japanese American.
Yeah.
And all of that stuff. So, in fact, my wife is Japanese.
Oh.
So I say that's why I think ahead it will be, you know, your generation that picks it up, the younger generation picks it up, who creates that Pan-Asian movement, national organization, or plural organization. It doesn't have to be one. We can have more, but I think we do need to have that where we can have a national voice and a national show of force. And we're getting there, but we're not there yet. So I think to the future, I fully expect that to happen. But it won't happen by itself. It'll only happen if somebody does that.
Well, thank you so much for the interview.
Sorry about all the technical issues, but
let's hope it just works.